Well, one other thing before we get started, I'm going to ask, because we're going to be covering some things from last week's Torah portion when we did not have services, as well as things from this week's. I want to ask you, if you don't mind, is it okay if we hold questions and comments, and if we have some time at the end, we'll do it then? Okay, I hate to do that, but once in a while, because of time constraints, it is necessary. So if you'll just resist that urge to raise your hand today, we'll be back to asking questions and sharing comments next week. But our Torah portion last week was called Korach, or Korah, a man's name. It begins in Numbers 16. I want to look at a few items in that Torah portion and then bring it on up into this week's Torah portion, which is Kuchat. In chapter 16 of Numbers, verse 1, it says, Korah, son of Izhar, son of Kohath, son of Levi, separated himself with Dathan and Abiram, sons of Eliab, and On, son of Peleth, the offspring of Reuben. They stood before Moses with 250 men from the children of Israel. Now, what kind of men were these? Leaders of the assembly, those summoned for meeting, men of name or men of renown. This is the cream of the cream of the crop. 250 with Korah at their head. They gathered together against Moses and against Aaron and said to them, "It is too much for you. For the entire assembly, all of them are holy, and Adonai is among them. Why do you exalt yourselves over the congregation of Adonai?" Moses heard and fell on his face. Now, I want to give Korah a fair shake here. I want us to stand in his shoes, if we can, and try to see things from his point of view. Because as you begin to really look at things from Korah's point of view, you might begin to think, yeah, what's wrong with what he said? What is wrong with what he did? I mean, let's think about this for a moment. Korah is of the tribe of Levi, just as Moses and Aaron are. And not only are they part of the tribe of Levi, they are the sons of Kohath. They are in charge of carrying the things that are inside the tabernacle, the Ark of the Covenant, and the menorah, and the altar of incense, and so on. They have very, very high and holy responsibilities in the tabernacle. And all this time, from the time they've left Egypt until this point, they've been watching what's going on with Moses and Aaron. And they've seen some things that are really inconsistent, some things there that just do not make sense. Here's the biggie. While Moses was up on top of Mount Sinai for 40 days and nights, some of the rabble rises up and says, "Let's make gods and lead us back to Egypt." And so who gives instructions for removing their earrings and giving them to Levi? Aaron does. Aaron says, "Give me the rings, the gold earrings." It says Aaron takes an engraving tool and he casts this thing and he makes a golden calf. Aaron does, the high priest, Moses' brother. And a bunch of the men begin to worship this thing and start to get party and get involved in sin. And they're all involved in it except for the Levites, though Aaron himself is a Levite. And when Moses comes down from the mountain with Joshua, he says, "Who's on the Lord's side?" And all the Levites gather to Moses because they weren't involved in this. And Moses tells them, "Okay, you put your swords on your hips and you go through the camp, and the people who are actively worshiping this thing, you kill them." And the tribe of Levi did. But Aaron didn't get killed. And then there's a plague that comes through and kills a bunch more who apparently had hearts that leaned towards worship, though they may not have been actively involved. But Aaron doesn't get killed. And because of Levite's faithfulness, Levi becomes the priestly tribe. And yet it was Moses' brother, Aaron, who made the golden calf, how come he gets off scot-free? He's the one who started this whole thing. And yet the Levites, his brothers, kill the ones involved in it. But Aaron, not only does he not get punished, he gets promoted. He's now the high priest. Do you know what the word nepotism means? Nepotism means giving favor and promotion to people you are related to. Maybe you've seen this at work or at maybe in schools or whatever, or in churches, where the pastor's family, they get the promotions, they get the positions. Boy, if there's ever a case of it, this would be an apparent case. Because here's Moses, the leader. And here's Aaron, who started this whole thing that brought death to so many. He gets promoted to be high priest. And then not only that, but Moses gives laws that say that we have to give the best cuts of the sacrifices to Aaron and his sons. And we pay tithes to Levi, but the Levites pay tithes to Aaron and his sons. And two of Aaron's sons didn't work out too well, because we know what happened to Nadab and Abihu, and they tried to take some incense in and did a botched job, and it cost them their lives. This isn't looking too good. Yeah, here's Kohath. Here's Korah. He's a leader among leaders. He's a man among men. And he's the one who loves God. He loves God. He loves the people of Israel. He is highly qualified to come alongside or maybe even to replace Aaron. And he's had enough. And when you look at things through Korah's eyes, through his logic, through his reasoning, it's pretty flawless. Oh, and here's another thing. How are we getting all these laws? Moses tells us. And Moses tells us that God tells him, but do we know that God tells him all these laws? We all heard God speak at Mount Sinai that one day. But all this other stuff coming down the pike, Moses says God told him. How do we know that? How do we know God told Moses to appoint his brother high priest? You begin to see things through Korah's eyes a little bit. But what's the thing that Korah is totally missing? What's the thing that goes completely outside of his logic? Well, if we go on down to chapter 16, verse 5, just going on to the next verse. Moses spoke to Korah and to his entire assembly, saying, "In the morning, Adonai, not me, but Adonai, the Lord, will make known the one who is his own and the Holy One, and he will draw him close to himself, and whomever he will choose, he will draw close to himself." Here's the thing that Korah missed: God's choice. Korah may have been much more qualified to be high priest, much more qualified than Aaron. It's just one problem. God didn't choose Korah. He chose Aaron. Makes no sense. It's a paradox. And you see, as long as Korah does Korah's job, it's fine. But the moment he steps over the line of what God has given Korah to do, he's now fighting against God. Go down to verse 11. "Therefore," Moses says, "therefore you and your entire assembly that are joining together are against the Lord." And for this, for Aaron, what is he? Do you protest against him? In other words, it's not about you, Korah. It's not about Aaron. It's not about me. It's all about God and his choices. And he makes choices we don't make. His ways aren't our ways. And for some reason, he picks terribly unqualified men to do his work. Do you ever think about some of the unqualified men God has chosen to do his work? I was just thinking through real quick. I jotted down a few. How about Samson? Here's a guy who couldn't get anything right the whole time he lived. He was empowered by God with tremendous strength, and every decision he made was dead wrong. The only time he ever accomplished anything good was in his death. But he continued to follow after sin, and that sin made him weak. It made him blind, and it made him stupid. And then eventually it made him dead. And in his death, he accomplished more than he ever did in his life. How about Gideon? Here's a man totally unqualified to lead an army. He's hiding in a hole, winnowing his wheat, and God just kind of shows up and greets him as Gideon, you mighty man of the Lord. Mighty man of the Lord? He's a frightened farmer is all he is, but God chooses him. How about David? When Samuel shows up at Jesse's house, because God's told him one of Jesse's sons will be the next king of Israel, Jesse didn't even bring in David. He was totally unqualified. Now my other sons, they are eminently qualified to be king. Just pick one. Look at them. But none of them were God's choice. David was God's choice. How about Yeshua? What in the world qualified him to be the Messiah of Israel? I mean, his birth didn't look all that right. Born of a virgin, Mary's pregnant before she's married, and he's a son of a carpenter from Nazareth. Can any good thing come out of Nazareth? And a lot of people had a real hard time accepting the fact that he was indeed the anointed one of Israel, that he was God's choice. We go on with Peter, Paul. And you know, it was a funny thing. Adam Haynes was over this week, a couple nights ago. We got to talk, and I hadn't thought about it until then to include it. But you know, some of you, a lot of the couples here have gone through a marriage class that we've hosted in our home. Rob and I, we've done it a few times, and we go through some videos. It's a great time, and we'll be doing it again. But the couples who come through, we do these things called flag pages. It's this thing that takes about 5 minutes. You do it on the internet, then it prints out this total personality picture of who you are. It's pretty amazing. And everybody comes in and does this is very skeptical, but when they read it, it's powerful. We do it with couples when we do premarital counseling, and it's a powerful, powerful tool. And it's amazingly accurate. And so I'd forgotten about mine, and here about a few months ago, I dug it up and looked at it again because we were talking about flag pages. And the flag page measures 5 major areas. It measures your comfort in front of people, talking to people, you know, your showmanship or whatever you call it, and your creativity and your work ethic and your leadership skills and your people skills. Guess what my people skills are? 0. And my leadership skills? 0 again. I did pretty well in the other 3. But I have no leadership skills, and I have no people skills, which doesn't take some of you by surprise at all. But it's like, when I look at that, I am absolutely, totally unqualified to be sitting up here. I have no business being up here and being a congregational leader of this place. So why am I here? It's God's paradox. God works in paradoxical ways. I brought some illustrations. I shared some of you. I look back at my notes, it's about 5 years ago that I shared some of these. I've added a couple more to the list just to give you an idea, a picture of how paradox works. Now, you know what a paradox is? Let me give you a definition. Yeah, paradox, a couple definitions. It's a statement or proposition that seems self-contradictory or absurd, but in reality expresses a possible truth. Another definition is any person, thing, or situation exhibiting an apparently contradictory nature. Something is totally contradictory. I mean, let's think about something. A human being is a paradox. Because here we are, bodies of flesh, animal bodies, ape bodies, and yet the breath of God, the neshama of God dwells within us. So there's this part of us that is totally physical and involved in the physical realm, another part that is utterly spiritual. Totally contradictory, but dwelling together in this tabernacle called the human body. So let me just give you some illustrations, some pictures up here. And some of you may have seen these before, and if you have, it's still fine because it still illustrates the point. First one is like a little profile of a man's face. See the eyes, you see the nose, the mouth, the chin, a bit of the neck. Just look at this picture. Would you trust this guy? Would you trust him? I wouldn't, because you see, he's a liar. All right? Nothing changes in the picture. But the picture says two things. But we tend to only see one thing. You know, in the Psalms, David writes, two things, one thing have you spoken, two things have I heard. And everything God speaks, everything he does is very paradoxical. Now, the person who can only see the face, people, who, in other words, who cannot see paradox, you know what we call them? We call them religious. But people who can see two things, at what God speaks, what God does, what God creates, we call them spiritual. Let's give another one. Okay, here's some numbers. 3,414, 340, there's a line, and then 437. This is a math problem. Do you see how they derive 437 from those first two numbers? Makes no sense, does it? Until you flip it over, then you see that 9 plus 1 equals 10. Oh, and here's a picture of a horse. All right, there's a horse. Horse's head in the stable. You see the other animal? And there's a frog sitting down at the bottom of the stable. Now, this little thing, I hear you laughing. That's exactly what you're supposed to do, because this is something that's incongruent. Frogs and horses have nothing to do with each other, yet this same picture is a picture of a frog and it's a picture of a horse. And there's something inside of us that delights at that, because this illustrates optically something's very spiritual. Because that little thing inside of you that flipped over, when I turned the picture, you saw the horse become a frog. That little experience, that little tiny switch that flipped over from horse to frog, that little switch should be flipping over in you all the time. Especially when you experience something very negative in your life. Because you see, God does only good in our lives. But we tend to equate pleasure with good and pain with bad. God only gives us good. Sometimes it's pleasant and sometimes it's unpleasant, but it's always, always, always good. And so the next time you come to a place where there's pressure, there's tension, there's stress, there's pain, learn how to rotate the picture. Learn how to look at the situation differently and be patient. And that little switch will flip, and then you'll see the light in the darkness. You'll see the good inside the pain. And then there'll be this joy that wells up. Here's another one. I love this one. I'm going to show you half of the picture. There you see it looks like a block of wood or something, and there's a little ledge sticking out of it, and there's a marble up on top of the wood, and then two marbles on the little shelf sticking out, right? Nothing complicated. Let's look at the other half of the picture. Now we see that there's two shelves sticking out of the block of wood, three marbles on the top and one on the bottom, right? There's a picture of spirituality right there. You look at the left, you see one thing. You look at the right, you see another. And as we know in Scripture, and God even made our bodies this way. We have a left and a right. And all through the Scriptures, the left side is the physical, the right side is the spiritual. They do not contradict one another. They work in harmony with one another in ways that are absolutely unbelievable. And the Scriptures tell us that the heart of the wise is to the right and the heart of the fool is to the left. It doesn't mean the physical is bad. It just means the wise man looks to the spiritual first. He always stresses the spiritual, because out of it flows the physical. All right, now before I put this one up, I'll give you a little heads up. All right, there's going to be a picture of three girls here. Two of them are sitting on a ball, and the other one is not. Can you figure out which one is not? Okay? Oh, I'm going to hear about this at home. All right. But look, you're getting good at this. You noticed it right away, didn't you? See? You're growing. I saved this one for last. I really don't need to comment on it. But there are obviously two pictures here. There's a picture of a tree and another tree, and there's some buildings in the back, and a woman here with a dress kind of walking from right to left. But it's also a man's head with the eyes, the nose, the mouth. If only we could always do in life daily what you can do optically with these slides. Because if you have eyes to see, you will always see the hand of God in everything that happens in your life, in your circumstances, consistently, constantly, always. He says, I will never leave you nor forsake you. But do you have eyes to see just how close he is? Or you just kind of go around with a patch over one eye. You only look at the eye through the world through the physical, and you're always moaning and complaining and whining because things aren't going right. Oh, if only we could see the spiritual. My definition of spirituality is this: a spiritual person is one who sees God everywhere and in everything, and remains quiet about it. Not silent, just quiet. That kind of person is always happy. Okay? Because they see what's going on behind the scenes. They see God's hand at work all the time. Now, I bring up these paradoxes because Moses, to a great degree, is unqualified to be a leader of Israel. And Aaron, by all means, was unqualified to be high priest. And Korah was eminently qualified to be high priest. One problem: God chose Aaron, God did not choose Korah. End of story. You see, when it comes to spiritual authority, God does not accept volunteers. He'll accept volunteers for service and for obedience, but for positions of spiritual authority, he does not accept volunteers. Yet, let me show you another paradox in this. You know what happens to Korah. God makes a new thing happen. The earth just opens up and swallows up Korah and his household and his property, and then the earth just like he never existed. Korah wanted to be elevated spiritually and in authority. Instead, he just descended alive right into the ground. Yet, when you go over to chapter 17, look at this. Verse 1. Adonai spoke to Moses, saying, say to Eleazar, son of Aaron the Kohen, and let him pick up the fire pans from mid the fire. You see, here's how the test was going to work. God had Moses tell Korah, or have Korah fill his fire pan with coals and incense, and all of his 250 men, they'll bring their incense before the Lord, hoping they'd remember what happened to Nadab and Abihu when they tried this and died. So these 250 men bring their fire pans, and God does not accept it. And then the earth opens up, swallows up Korah. And these other 250 men die. So what do you do with these fire pans? Say to Eleazar, son of Aaron the Kohen, and let him pick up the fire pans from amid the fire, and he should throw away the flame, for they have become holy. What? Korah the rebel and his 250 rebellious friends, their fire pans are now holy? You'd think the earth had just opened up, swallowed them up as well. But even though Korah and his men were rebels, they were actually against God, the fire pans that they brought, God says, but they're holy. As for the fire pans of these sinners against their souls, they shall make them hammered out sheets as a covering for the altar. For they offered them before the Lord, so they became holy. You know, in this same Torah portion, if you go on a little bit further to chapter 20, we see another little mini rebellion, this time by Moses himself. After Miriam's death, the rock that had been following them for 40 years quit giving water. And so God tells Moses, go to the rock, speak to it, it'll give water again. In verse 9 it says, Moses took the staff from before Adonai as he had commanded him. Moses and Aaron gathered the congregation before the rock, and he said to them, listen now, you rebels, shall we bring forth water for you from this rock? And Moses raised his arm and struck the rock with his staff twice. Instead of speaking to it, he struck it. It says, abundant water came forth, and the assembly and their animals drank. Moses disobeyed God. Out of anger, he disobeyed him, but God still provided water in a miraculous way from the rock. So what are the consequences? Adonai said to Moses and to Aaron, verse 12, because you did not believe in me to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you will not bring this congregation to the land that I have given them. They are the waters of strife where the children of Israel contended with the Lord, and he was sanctified through them. What's the them he's referring to? The waters. Compare these two. Korah's a rebel, and the earth swallows him up. But the fire pans he and his friends brought become holy. And they travel with the altar. They become a covering for the altar for the rest of the duration of that tabernacle. Moses, he sins. Says, speaking to the rock in anger, he strikes it. And because of that, he and Aaron were not permitted to enter the land of Canaan. But God says, but I will be made holy by the waters that came out of the rock. Let me share an important insight and a principle here. Korah was dead wrong and his 250 followers, and then Moses was dead wrong here. And yet these dead wrong men were used by God to bring about something holy. Don't ever think for a moment that because God works a miracle through an individual, that therefore that individual is his man, or that individual is a holy person, or a righteous person, or is an obedient person, or in God's will. I think one of the things the enemy has done these days, and if we're not on our guard, we can fall prey to this, is that he will use ungodly men, and yet God will still work a miracle through them. But it's not an endorsement of the man. You understand? I mean, in next week's Torah portion, we're going to see God speaking through a donkey. That doesn't mean we should put donkeys behind the pulpit. You see? So make sure you get hold of that principle. It's a paradox. How can God use a rebel like Korah, these 250 rebels who followed him, and their fire pans become holy? How could God take this fit of anger in which Moses speaks, in this rebellion, in this anger, in this disobedience, but he still brings the water from the rock? He's going to be sanctified by the waters, if not by Moses. Do you get it? Our God only has imperfect equipment and tools to use, but he uses them in mighty ways. You know, even where Moses speaks there, when he says, hear, O rebels, in Hebrew, it's Shamuna Morim. Listen up, you rebels. Do you know the word Morim, rebels, the exact same identical word as Miriam, Moses' sister? You'll find in Hebrew this amazing thing about the Hebrew language. It's just absolutely mind-boggling. It can be very confusing and frustrating at first, but then you kind of flow with it. You begin to see the wonders of what God does, because there are so many words in Hebrew that mean one thing and then also mean the exact opposite of that thing, and you look at the context to see which it is. Miriam is one example. You could take the word katat, which means sin. But katat also means to be purified from sin. The word panim, which is usually translated face, can mean the external, but panim is also used to refer to the internal. How about the word kadosh? Kadesh. Kadesh. There are different ways to pronounce the same word. Kadosh means holy. And yet you know what a temple prostitute was called among the pagan religions? Same word. Exact same word. Yet couldn't be more unholy. I mean, more unrighteous. How about the word shachar, which means black? And yet the morning prayers are called shacharis. It comes from the word shachar. It means the morning, the dawning of the light. How can the same word, which means dark and black, mean the dawning of the light? But it does. God is a God of paradoxes. You can't deal with that. You can be religious. You can never be spiritual. I mean, after all, do you really want a God like you? I'll take that as a no. And yet, people who worship idols, what do? They make idols in their own image. Or worse, they make them the image of an animal. And what we tend to do is we read the word about the God, the creator of the universe, but we want to somehow mold him into our image, at least where he works the way we think he should work. We want him to be tame and controllable. We want a God we can manipulate, so when we say certain words and certain prayers, if we add in Jesus' name to the end of a prayer, then God's held hostage. He's got to do what we say now. Do we really want a God in our image? No. And what kind of God would that be worth? We're made in his image, and we should be growing to be more like him, and we have a paradoxical God. He's a God who says he even dwells in the thick darkness. Even the darkness to him is light. God is a God who can take the greatest sin in the world, the crucifixion of his son, and turn that into the greatest blessing in human history. In fact, that's what our next Torah portion is about. Go now to Chukat, which begins in Numbers chapter 19. Chukat. Chukat comes from the word koch, which means a commandment which has absolutely no foundation in human logic. And they call this commandment about the red heifer as the prime example of a koch, something that totally defies logic. Let's read a little bit about what the red heifer is all about. We'll read the first 10 verses. Numbers 19, starting with verse 1. Adonai spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying, "This is the koch, or the chukat of the Torah." Chukat means decree of. "Which Adonai has commanded, saying, 'Speak to the children of Israel, and they shall take to you a completely red cow.'" A heifer is a female cow. I think I shared this a long time ago, but you know, my parents are from Tennessee. And for the longest time as a kid, I thought a heifer was a bad driver. From my dad. I mean, that's how my dad used the term. I was much later, I realized it was a cow. But anyways, it's a cow. And this is a para aduma. It's a red cow, which is without blemish, and upon which a yoke has not come. You shall give it to Eleazar the Kohen. He shall take it to the outside of the camp, and someone shall slaughter it in his presence. Now already this is bizarre, because this is the only sacrifice that would be sacrificed outside of the tabernacle, outside of the camp. And it's not done by the priest. It can be done by anybody as long as the priest is watching. Eleazar the Kohen shall take some of its blood with his forefinger and sprinkle it, some of its blood, toward the tent of meeting 7 times. All the other times blood is sprinkled, it's in the tent of meeting before the curtain or onto the altar itself. But this is way outside the camp, and he just sees the tabernacle in the camp way off in the distance. He just sprinkles the finger with the blood on it in that direction. Someone shall burn the cow before his eyes. Its hide and its flesh and its blood with its dung shall he burn. He's burned the entire thing. The Kohen shall take cedar wood, hyssop, and crimson thread. He shall throw them into the burning of the cow. Now, what's the purpose of this? Here it is. The Kohen shall immerse his clothing and immerse himself in water, and afterwards he may enter the camp. And the Kohen shall remain contaminated until evening. The one who burns it shall immerse his clothing, immerse himself in water. He shall remain contaminated until evening. A pure man shall gather the ash of the cow and place it outside the camp in a pure place. For the assembly of Israel it shall remain as a safekeeping for water of purification. The one who gathered the ash of the cow shall immerse his clothing and remain contaminated until evening. It shall be for the children of Israel and for the proselyte or the sojourner who dwells among them as an eternal decree. The purpose of the ashes of this heifer, that they would be mixed with water, take a little bit with a large amount of water, and these containers of water with the ashes, would there be several containers, and they would be spread out all over Israel. So when someone was contaminated by coming in contact with a dead body, they would go to the local priest. He would sprinkle them with this water with the ashes of the red heifer, and they would be made pure. That's the purpose of these ashes. But here's the thing that nobody could quite get. If the ashes of this cow makes the impure pure, then why is it that those who kill the cow, burn the cow, gather the ashes of the cow, are all made impure by their involvement? I mean, in the tabernacle, when the priest sacrificed an animal, sacrificing the animal did not make the priest impure. But in this case, for this sacrifice, any involvement whatsoever with this sacrifice makes that person impure. But the ashes of this sacrifice make the impure pure. Let me read a little bit of what the sages say about this. It says that the Midrash to this chapter focuses primarily on one paradox in the laws of the red cow. Its ashes purify people who had become contaminated, yet those who engage in its preparation become contaminated. It was regarding this aspect of its laws that King Solomon exclaimed, quote, "I said I would be wise, but it is far from me," unquote. That's from Ecclesiastes 7:23. He said this stumped Solomon. He could not figure this out. On this theme, the Midrash cites the verse Job 14:4. Who can draw a pure thing out of an impure one? No one. Job said, who can draw an impure thing who can draw a pure thing out of an impure one? No one. But that phrase in Hebrew where it says lo ichad, not one, can also be translated this way. Who can draw a pure thing out of an impure one? Is it not the one? Is there not one who can? And there is. Now, anyone who knows the gospel story understands the red heifer. The red heifer is a picture of Messiah. Everyone involved in his death committed a terrible crime, a terrible sin, and they were tainted by that. Because here was the purest person who ever lived, sinless, the Son of God, the Torah made flesh, and they murdered him. Those who tried him were guilty of passing a false sentence. Those who beat him were guilty of beating an innocent man. Those who drove the nails into his hands and feet were guilty of murdering an innocent man. Everyone, from the priest to Pilate to the Roman soldiers and everyone in between, every contact they had with Messiah as they participated in his death, they all committed tremendous sin. It was the greatest sin ever committed. And yet, it was his death that brings forgiveness and purity to the entire world. You see? Talk about a paradox. There's a paradox, if there ever was one. Messiah himself is a paradox. It's one of the things that makes him the Messiah. Do you really want a Messiah who thinks and acts like you? No, I don't think so. There's another great paradox in this chapter. There are two animals in this chapter, and we have to learn to think paradoxically, because the menorah itself, I'm always talking about the menorah pattern, right? The menorah is an embodiment of a paradox, because you've got this central stalk, and then you've got branches that go off to the left, and for every branch to the left, you've got one that's totally opposite. It goes off to the right. But that's where the balance is. You see that the menorah itself is the embodiment, a physical embodiment of paradox, of opposites that come together in perfect balance to provide great light. So in this Torah portion of Kukat, we have two animals. First one's the red heifer. What's the other animal? Snake. You think a horse and a frog are opposites. So how about a red cow and then a poisonous snake? But you go over to chapter 21. Chapter 21. Verse 4. They journeyed from the Mount Hor by way of the Sea of Reeds to go around the land of Edom. And the spirit of the people grew short on the way. The people spoke against God and Moses. Why did you bring us? I have to put my whiny voice on. Why did you bring us up from Egypt to die in this wilderness? I mean, does that ever get old? If there's any part of the Bible I find boring, it's the whining that these people do. It's like I just want to go on to the next verse. Verse 6, God sent the fiery serpents. Fiery, it's the word seraph, which means, you know, we have seraphim, which are the fire angels, the angels of fire. But seraph means to burn with fire. And I would imagine it was not because these serpents were on fire, but their bites felt like fire. I've been told that, well, have you ever been stung by a bee or a hornet? If that burning sensation? Well, I've heard that the venom of a snake is the same thing, just multiply it by 100. So these are called fiery serpents because their bite caused such a sensation of fire and burning. God sent the fiery serpents against the people, and they bit the people. A large multitude of Israel died. The people came to Moses and said, "We have sinned." Finally. Finally they figured it out. "We have sinned, for we have spoken against the Lord and against you. Pray to Adonai that he remove from us the serpent." Moses prayed for the people. Now here's the paradox. Adonai said to Moses, "Make a fiery." It doesn't say serpent there. That's implied. But make a fiery. Make a fiery serpent. Well, wait a minute. Stop the music. Serpents are the problem. We don't need another serpent. We want to get rid of the serpents. The prayer is to make the serpents go away, and you want me to make another one? Let's go on. And place it on a pole. You know, I always thought common sense, human logic is say, what you should make is a fiery mongoose and put it on a pole. Because mongooses eat, is it mongoose? Mongooses eat snake. We were in Jamaica on our cruise, and we took a little bus tour, and they took us up in the rainforest and everything, and the lady was saying we used to have a terrible snake problem in Jamaica up until 150 years ago or something like that, and the British brought in all these mongooses and just turned them loose on the island, and there are no snakes in Jamaica anymore. But they said we're overrun by mongooses. And later on in the bus, we saw one go across the road. She said, "Oh, there's a mongoose right there." And you'd think a mongoose would be the solution. But no, God says make another serpent. And put it on a pole. And it will be that anyone who is bitten will look at it and live. Moses made a serpent of copper, or yours might say bronze. We don't know how to translate that word nachashet in Hebrew, but he made one out of copper bronze. Bronze is mostly made of copper anyway, bronze and I think a little tin, and placed it on the pole. So it was that if the serpent bit a man, he would stare at the copper serpent and live. What in the world is this a picture of? It's a picture of the same thing that the red heifer is a picture of. What did Yeshua become? He who knew no sin became sin. That's a powerful insight. Sin was the problem. And so the Messiah comes, and he becomes sin for us. He just took sin, just soaked it right up out of the world, out of us, out of our souls. Because you see, when you look at the sacrifices, never, ever was the animal to be tortured to death. It was never to be beaten, never to have nails driven through it, never to be mocked and spit on. It was to be killed as painlessly as possible, so the animal would have the sensation of just falling asleep. That wasn't the case with Messiah, though. Why? Because God was displaying for us what he has done to our sin. He's taken the hands of our sin and nailed them down to where they can't, they're ineffective, they're powerless. He's taken the feet of our sin. It can't take us where we want to go, where it wants to take us anymore. They're nailed down. He took the heart of our sin, drove a spear into it. He took the thoughts, the sinful thoughts, and impaled them with a crown of thorns. He took the mouth of sin, let it dry up so much to where Messiah said, "I thirst." You get the idea? Don't ever buy the stuff where God poured out his wrath on Yeshua on the cross. I hear preachers preach that once in a while. God poured out his wrath on Messiah. He had no wrath towards Messiah. It was his son, for Pete's sake. If God ever wept, that was when he wept right there. That wasn't God pouring out his wrath on Messiah. That was the enemy pouring out his wrath on him. And he was doing it through the priests, through the Romans, through all those involved in his death. And we all had a hand in it ourselves. But when you look in your mind at what happened to Messiah there on the cross, that's a picture of what God's done to your sin. And if you're continuing to sin, you have no excuse. You're sinning because you choose to, not because you have to. We're all weak. Our problem is our weakness, our inability, it seems like, to say no, but you can say no. And if we walk in his word and we feed upon his word, we'll have strength to walk out of that slavery and to walk as free people. There's a powerful insight in the Hebrew here, and I know many of you are familiar with this, but we'll close with this. If you look in the Hebrew, if you can find it over, you have a Hebrew Bible, look over at the Hebrew side, you will see there in that verse the word nachash. Nachash is the word for serpent. And there it is as it's spelled in the Hebrew. Nun chet shin. Nachash. All right? Everybody got that? Now in the Hebrew alphabet, the last letter of the alphabet, the letter tav, means cross. And that is not a Christian interpretation. I discovered this, as I've told you before, in a Jewish Hebrew grammar book. And since then, I found it, if you know where to look, in the Hebrew books published by Jewish publishing companies, they all will say that the last letter of the alphabet represents a cross. And you may think, well, that doesn't look like a cross. Well, the crosses you're used to seeing are shaped like a T. But when Yeshua was crucified, it doesn't appear he was crucified on a T-shaped structure. You know, you see in the movies where they dig a hole and they put him on the cross, they drop it down the hole and make it very dramatic. It didn't happen like that. Face it, the Romans want to make it as easy on themselves as possible. If there's a place of public crucifixion, they're going to leave the post in the holes all the time. They're not going to dig new holes every time they crucified anybody, or they'd be digging holes every day. They left the uprights in the holes all the time. So when Yeshua carried his cross, he carried the cross beam, the horizontal part, on his shoulders. That's what he carried. And when they nailed him down, they nailed his hands to the cross beam. They put it up in place, and they hung it on the verticals. So it was shaped like that, more or less. So his hands were crucified, nailed out this way, and his feet would have been crucified in a spread eagle position, like an X. And what's interesting is that there's another way of writing Hebrew letters, the Paleo-Hebrew, and when you make the letter Tav in Paleo-Hebrew, it's shaped like an X. All right? But regardless, we'll all find out exactly how it all worked later on. But needless to say, the fact remains that the last letter of the alphabet, the letter Tav, means cross. Nachash is serpent. Tav is cross. And Moses made a Nachash, Nachashet. Look at the word for brass. You see it? There's Nachash, Nun, Ket, Shin. But this time, it's attached to Tav, the cross. This is how it appears in the Bible. Brazen serpent is Nachash, Nachashet. Nachash is serpent, but the word for brass is Nachashet. That is no accident. See what's being portrayed here? See what's being pictured? Here's the serpent attached to the cross. Here's our sin attached to the cross. And when they looked at this, they were healed. They lived. Now, there's a paradox. Paradox is the very nature of our God. Loving paradox. Wise paradox. Always keeping us guessing, because he's always doing two things at a time, at least, never just one. But do we have the eyes to see beyond the physical? What a wonderful God we have. What an incredible God. How wise. I titled this slide, "The Problem is the Solution." That's one of my favorite sayings, because Robin and I, since we discovered this principle, for years now, every time a problem comes along, we almost race to see who's the first one to say the problem's the solution. It's always, always, always proven true. If you look at the problem, look at it closely, let it play out, you'll see that in the problem it contains the solution itself to something much broader than what you thought the problem was. This is how our God works. This is how he hides himself. And you know what? As much as I long to see him face to face, and someday every one of us will, in the meantime, in this world, under the conditions we live in now, I wouldn't change a thing. If it was better for us to be able just to see him clearly without any obstruction, without any fog between us and the truth, he would do that. But for right now, the very best place we could possibly be is where we're at right this moment in the conditions we're living right now. But let's do it with both eyes open now. I hope this teaching that's on my heart just gives you at least a desire to see things better and to realize there is more to see than what you're seeing. Look for more than what just appears to the eye. Remember the illustrations we put up here on the overhead and begin to practice this every day of your life. And look for God's hand in everything, because it's always there. He promises that it is. And if it's not, then he lied to us, since he's incapable of lying. He speaks the truth. And like Rabbi David Aaron says, if you have trouble seeing God, it's not because he's so far away. It's because he's so close. That's why we have trouble seeing him sometimes. Well, let's close in prayer. Father, thank you so much for being exactly the way you are. You don't need to change. You're perfect. And forgive us for the times we wish you were different. And Messiah himself said, "Blessed is the man whosoever is not offended in me." So Lord, forgive us if we've ever been offended because you didn't do things our way. But Lord, it's not you who needs to change. We do. We need to grow up. We need to mature. We need to become the people you want us to be. So, Father, I pray you give us a clear vision of reality. Help us to see the physical realm and how it works, and get a good education and understanding and knowledge to the best of our abilities. But, Father, with that, give us spiritual insight as to what's going on behind the scenes, So we recognize your hand in everything that takes place. For you are there. For the very creation that conceals you also reveals you if we but can see it. So, Father, I pray you'd give us the ability to see you better and as a result to be more like you. And in the time we have left here in this flesh, on this earth, may we continue to grow and reach the goal of full stature, and that we might appear before you as faithful servants, as the men and the women, as the sons and the daughters you desire us to be. And this we'll do with your help. We ask in Yeshua's name. Amen.